Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers. This is episode number 69, The Flavor Puzzle, with Joe Davighi. Joe is a theoretical physicist at the Physics Institute at the University of Zurich. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/69. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast and related episodes of Physics Frontiers. And now, Jim and Joe.
Hello, Joe. How are you today?
Hi, Jim. Very good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. So I brought you on here today to talk about a couple of your papers. The Electroweak Flavor Unification here, which you wrote with Joseph Tooby Smith. And the one that I caught on the archive was Gauge Flavor Unification from the Flavor Puzzle to Sable Protons. And as soon as you said puzzle, you got me.
Okay, cool. It's definitely a puzzle.
Okay. All right. I read through a long time ago the leptic quarks with exactly Sable protons, but I didn't reread it, so we probably don't have any questions about that. But feel free to talk about the leptic quarks if you think they're important at any point, all right?
Sure, let's see. Okay.
All right, so what I'd like to start off with is basically to ask you what sort of problem you're trying to solve.
So, yeah, the problem is what's called the flavor puzzle in particle physics. So I'll give a bit of background because this is probably not too familiar. But what probably is familiar, we all learn in school that everything is made of atoms, and the atoms are made of electrons and then protons and neutrons. And the electron, as far as we know, is a fundamental particle. The protons and neutrons aren't. They're made of up quarks and down quarks. But very roughly, everything that we see around us is made of those three particles, electrons, up quarks, and down quarks. There's also neutrinos, but we can largely forget about those here. The flavor puzzle is the fact that particle physicists have discovered that for each of these particles, there's actually two more copies of them. And these copies otherwise look exactly the same as the electron, up quark, and down quark. They're just a lot heavier. So for example, there's something called a muon, and this behaves almost exactly like an electron. It's just 200 times heavier. I have no idea why it's there. Likewise, there's a tau particle, which is like an even heavier version of an electron. It's like 3,000 times heavier. And the same structure is there for the quarks. So there's heavy versions of the up quark and of the down quark. And again, there are these huge differences in their masses. So the top quark, for example, which wasn't discovered until the 90s in the Tevatron, this is about 100,000 times heavier than the up quark, but otherwise it's got exactly the same properties. So the flavor puzzle is really two questions. The first question is, why are there these three copies of everything when everything we know of is made of just one generation? So why are they there? And then the secondly is why are they so heavy? Why are these other generations so much heavier than their familiar counterparts? And in the standard model of particle physics, there's no explanation at all of either of these puzzles, which we kind of group together as the flavor puzzle.
Excellent. So you're trying to solve the flavor puzzle. And I guess we want to know how you're doing this. So you're using this same sort of symmetry methods, the same sort of symmetry methods that you get from Georgie or someone like that to investigate these things. So could you explain how that works briefly? Yeah. I mean, we don't want to get into it too much because we'll have a long time to talk about it.
Yeah. So the essence of the idea is that these three generations basically started off life in the very early universe as just one fundamental particle. So in other words, the three flavors or generations were once unified. So the different flavor components of the fundamental particle were basically just like different states of the same particle at that time. Sometimes the particle looks more like an electron, and then sometimes it, you know, oscillates and looks more like a muon. So in the early universe, this particle could flicker between these, you know, these different flavors, these different states, and it would do that by emitting some force-carrying particles. And these would be new forces, so not forces that we see in the standard model. And these forces would change the flavor of particles. And in our approach, in the early universe, these new flavor-changing forces would have exactly the same strength as the electromagnetic and weak forces that govern particle dynamics today. And so we call this idea electroweak flavor unification, because the electroweak force was at some point in the early universe unified with these forces that change flavor. So this is a consistent way of formulating this idea that all these three generations started life as one particle. And then the idea would be that as the universe evolved and cooled down, there's some phase transition, and this unification was broken. And when this unification symmetry gets broken, two things happen. The first is that this fundamental particle splits into three, the three generations. And the second is that these exotic new forces become very weak. So you don't really see them anymore. This is how it kind of matches on to what we see today. And this phase transition is a dynamical process. And we figured out that this can naturally produce wildly different masses for the different generations that you get at the end. So this kind of mechanism can produce exactly the kind of low energy spectrum of particles that we actually see in the universe today. So that's the rough outline of the idea.
Okay, so if I'm getting this right, you're saying that this actually answers a question that I was going to ask later on, I think. You're saying that in the early universe, you said the electron, the muon, the tau particle, for example, were all part of the same field.
Yes, exactly.
I expect. So they're all excitations in the same field, as I think about it. But then at some point later on, the transitions, you're saying, as the universe cools, I guess, the transitions turn off.
That's exactly right, yeah. It's like I could draw an analogy if people know a little bit about QCD, quantum chromodynamics, and the strong interaction, which basically quarks come in three different colors. And, you know, gluons can change quarks from one color to another. So it's exactly analogous to that. We now have these extra forces that change generations into each other. And yeah, as you say, it would be as if when the universe cooled, these interactions that change color somehow got frozen out. Of course, that doesn't happen in QCD, but it would happen with these flavor changing symmetries in this approach.
I'd just like to kind of finish up this broad outline of what's going on and try to understand, are there other approaches to this flavor puzzle? And, you know, how does your work relate to them? I mean, just in a general way.
The flavor puzzle is an old puzzle. There's many, many approaches going back to, you know, 70s and 80s. So just to give one example, maybe, there's a much more established approach in the literature to explaining these mass hierarchies, which is something we call flavor deconstruction. So the idea here is quite different to what I just outlined. The idea here is that in the early universe, each of the three generations interacts with its own set of standard model-like forces. So there's, you know, a strong interaction for the first generation. There's a separate strong interaction for the second generation, etc. And this deconstruction of flavor can quite easily explain why their masses end up so differently today. But conceptually, this is kind of the opposite idea to the gauge flavor unification approach. So in this deconstruction, the different generations, they start out more different, whereas in the flavor unification approach that we're discussing, things start out more unified. So it's kind of interesting that these opposite directions can end up both explaining the same thing, which is these huge hierarchies in masses, and they do so just as well. That's just one example.
Okay, excellent, excellent. One thing I was thinking about most of the time while I was reading these things is, you know, the way you're talking about this, I'm not sure if this gets all the way up to a grand unified theory, but it's definitely a step towards it. So could you talk a little bit about how this relates to building up a grand unified theory? I don't think it gets there, right?
No, correct. Yeah, this is a good question. So to say something before that, unification can kind of mean two things in particle physics. You can either unify forces together, or you can unify matter fields together, or you can do both or do everything. So grand unification usually refers to the idea where all of the different forces of nature, you know, of which there are three in the standard model, ignoring gravity, unify into one force at high energies. So the most famous example is what we call the SU5 grand unified theory of Georgi, where the three gauge interactions we see today, the three forces, originally just came from this one SU5 force. But the other idea is that you can unify matter fields. So, for example, Patti and Salam, in their famous model from the early 70s, they don't unify forces together, but they unify quarks and leptons together. So in their model, the Patti-Salam model, a lepton becomes basically the fourth color of quark. And you have this SU3 is enlarged to this SU4 symmetry. So those are both unification, but the Georgi approach is what we call grand unification. And these flavor unification models I'm talking about here, it turns out you can't actually do this in a grand unified context. So you have to kind of give up something. So we chose to give up unification of forces. And this is the only way that you can actually unify all of the flavors together into one fundamental field. So it's kind of an interesting curiosity that it seems, just based on the maths, on the group theory, that you can't have everything in this context.
Okay, yeah, that is much more interesting an answer than I was expecting. That's really great. So we can unify the forces, or we can unify the particles, basically.
It's something very specific to do with the three generations and the specific particles within each generation.
All right, so now we want to get into a little bit of background here. I think we've already started talking a little bit about this, but I wanted to talk about how to count the fermions, because while I was reading these, we were talking about flavors, and we're talking about generations, and we're talking about families.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And this is starting to get really confusing. All right, so...
Yeah, it is. I mean, I should probably apologize on behalf of the field, because this is pretty much a jargon problem, in that roughly we have three words for the same thing. So roughly those three words, flavor, generation, and family, all kind of mean the same thing. So you have three generations of matter. Within each generation, you have something like an electron, an up quark, a down quark, and a neutrino. You know, the only subtle difference is maybe you might use the word flavor, might also distinguish up and down as two different flavors, not just the three generations, but roughly it's the same thing.
Okay, good. So I was sometimes getting that feeling and sometimes not, and that was really confusing me.
Bad jargon, sorry.
The papers aren't talking to me, right? So I'd like to talk a little bit about just symmetry in the standard model, a little bit how to interpret some of these things. So, for example, I mean, you have SU2 symmetry sitting around all over the place. You know, most people are used to SU2 symmetry just because they're used to spins of electrons and things like that. And this is basically the symmetry for the measurements of the electron, basically. So if you're looking at all the weird things that happen with the Stern-Gerlach device, that's all basically SU2 symmetry, making you very, very sad. Or maybe it's making you happy. I don't know. It's one of the two, right? But I'd like to understand how to interpret these a little bit in, you know, this field theory context. What does this mean about the fermion, this SU2 or the U1Y or whatever?
So symmetry, of course, is, you know, one of the key mathematical concepts underpinning particle physics. And one place in which symmetry plays a really important role is in describing the forces of the standard model. So all three standard model forces, the strong force, the weak force, and the electromagnetic force, these are all mediated by a kind of particle which is called a gauge boson. And these gauge bosons are intimately connected to symmetries. So I'll try and explain a little bit about how that works. Again, I'll sketch it using an example, which is QCD, so the strong interaction. So this strong force acts on quarks, and a quark can come in three different states. And because there's three of them, we call it color, because we can think of them as red, green, and blue. This is, of course, just a label for the fact that a quark can come in three different varieties, if you like. Now, the color of a quark can change. Say it can change from red to green. But this process only makes sense if it emits one of these gauge bosons, which in this case is called a gluon. And this interaction by which a quark changes its color by emitting a gluon is called a gauge interaction. And basically, all of the standard model forces work like this. And then the exchange of these gluons between the colored quarks then creates a force between them, connecting them. And this turns out to be an extremely strong force that glues the quarks together. Now, so what's the connection with symmetries? So that still probably isn't clear. The idea is that all of the possible color transformations, so going from red to green or to blue or to even mixtures of those colors, that all those different transformations are what we call symmetries of the theory. And they all require these gauge bosons to make sense. Symmetries of the theory in the same way that, you know, you can think of all the different ways you could rotate or flip a dice, right? Those would be the symmetries of the dice. So all the ways that you can change the color of the quark are like symmetries of the theory. And the set of these symmetries forms something that we call a group in mathematics. So the upshot of this, which I feel like I explained very badly, is that any given force is described by a set of gauge bosons, and this corresponds to a particular group. And we call this the gauge group or the gauge symmetry. So as an example, the group that describes this strong interaction is something called SU3. And the number three there is just because there's these three colors. And you mentioned the group SU2, which describes the weak interaction. Again, this works very similarly. The weak gauge bosons, which are W bosons, basically, you know, flip a particle between two different states. And these are the symmetry transformations. In this case, those two states would be something like changing an up quark to a down quark for the weak theory. So yeah, this is a beautiful subject, which is called gauge theory. It's all about symmetries, and it's how we describe many forces in particle physics.
Okay. I guess if we're looking at the very simplest ideas of a group, right, you might just think of a wheel with three lines on it, and you can rotate the wheel. You can rotate it left, you can rotate it right, but you can always rotate it back to a situation where it looks exactly the same. And that's sort of the idea that they give you if you're an undergraduate in your abstract algebra course. If you have somebody, if you have somebody like that, it just gets a little more complicated here and there. Okay, so we have all of these symmetries. One other thing I wanted to look at is all of these models, right? They're products of these symmetries. Yeah. They're described as products of these symmetries. I don't want to say they are products of the symmetries, that maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but they're just at least described that way.
Yeah.
These just look like, you know, basic tensor products. We have this symmetry, that symmetry, that symmetry. I just want to make sure that there's not a huge... How important is it, for example, that these are in a particular order, or is that just a convention?
Yeah, so the order is a convention. But yeah, so what does it mean if the symmetry of a theory, of a gauge theory, so the gauge group is a product of two more basic groups? It basically just means those are two distinct forces. So if my symmetry is a product SU3 times SU2, you can think of product as meaning the word and. So it's like you've got a strong force and a weak force, and those two things don't themselves interact with each other. So that's what the product means. And the product, if you like, is commutative. You could write this in either order. It doesn't mean anything.
Now, when we're talking about this, we're going to be talking about several layers of symmetry breaking in your theory here. I just want to have a description of what that means. And if we, and I think when we combine the electromagnetic force and the weak force, that might be a good way just to break it in before we go into your own theory. Could you please give me your description of how that works?
Sure. So that's a hard task. Symmetry breaking is a key element of this for sure. And this is, you know, not the easiest concept. And we have, you know, Peter Higgs and others to thank here. So there's many different notions of symmetry breaking in physics and in particle physics. But the one we're talking about here is spontaneous breaking of a gauge symmetry. So this idea of a gauge symmetry that I tried to introduce, which is related to a force. And breaking a gauge symmetry is basically what we call the Higgs mechanism. So roughly how this works is that there has to be another particle in the game, and this is called a Higgs particle. And this Higgs particle will fall into some particular state which doesn't respect the symmetry. And this breaking of the symmetry has some rather radical consequences. And that's the thing I'll try to explain, because that's what's important for us. So as you suggested, we can try and see how this works in the example of the electroweak theory. First, probably... revise a little bit what the electroweak theory is. Well, we can imagine going back in time to the early universe. So in the early universe, we had this electroweak symmetry. Electromagnetic forces were unified, as you said, and they're unified because the Higgs used to be in a different state, basically. And the electroweak gauge bosons then basically, you know, they change particles between two different types, as I alluded to before. So say up type and down type. So when the electroweak symmetry was a good symmetry of the universe, up and down quarks weren't separate particles. They were like two sides of the same coin, two sides of the same particle. A bit like the kind of thing I said at the very beginning, what we'll try and do with the flavors. So W bosons would have changed up to down quarks, just like changing color. And they also change electrons and neutrinos into each other. So this was the time when the electromagnetic and weak forces were unified, and all of these force-carrying particles were all massless, which is not the case today. So yeah, that's another thing I should have said. When a gauge symmetry is unbroken, like this early universe electroweak symmetry, then the force-carrying particles are massless. So for example, the photon, which mediates electromagnetism, this remains massless to this day because electromagnetism is never broken by a Higgs mechanism. Okay, so now onto the Higgs mechanism. The universe started off in this unbroken state, and as it evolves, the Higgs particle falls into some different state which breaks this electroweak symmetry. So what happens then is that the up and down quark, which were unified into the same particle by this symmetry, they now split apart into two different particles. And these different particles can now have different masses because they're no longer the same thing. And indeed, they do have different masses. And the second consequence is that some of the gauge bosons, these force-carrying particles, they become heavy, which wasn't allowed when the symmetry was exact. And these particles that become heavy are what we call the W and the Z bosons. And because they're heavy, they're hard to produce. And this means the forces that they transmit become very weak. Now, in the electroweak theory, there's a certain part of the symmetry that happens to remain unbroken by the state that the Higgs falls into. And this unbroken part is, of course, electromagnetism. And this is why the photon remains exactly massless, and therefore the force it transmits remains relatively strong, or more precisely, it remains long range.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. Some things, what you mean by weak, and therefore you mean short range, is actually means there's an exponential decrease.
Exactly. Yeah. Massive, yeah.
And that's on top of the 1 over r squared.
Yes.
You have an additional exponential decrease.
Yeah, the 1 over r squared behavior of the force law is what we'd call long range.
Okay, so we've got, you know, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. That's your standard model. That's quarks, hypercharge, and then charge, I guess. I don't know. Okay. SU3, SU2, U1. What is SU3? What is SU2? And what is U1 for your standard model first? Okay. And then I'll ask the question I was trying to get to.
Okay. Sure. So, yeah. So the standard model is one of these things that I call a gauge theory. This is how we describe the forces of the standard model. And yeah, if you open a particle physics textbook, it will say this thing that you just said. The gauge symmetry is SU3 times SU2 times U1. But this is when it's written in the unbroken electroweak phase. So this was the case, if you like, in the early universe. This was the symmetry. And that U1 is not actually the U1 of electromagnetism. So in that formula, the SU2 times U1 hypercharge piece is what I was just calling electroweak symmetry, the whole thing. And then that's broken by the Higgs mechanism as a package, if you like. And there's a piece that remains, which is a different U1. So if you have studied any group theory, this different U1 is not U1y, it's some U1 subgroup of the whole SU2 times U1y. And that unbroken U1 subgroup is called electromagnetism. So at low energies, after the Higgs has, you know, broken the symmetry of particle physics is SU3 of the strong interaction times U1 electromagnetism.
Excellent. Okay, so that actually answered the question that I was about to ask, which is SU3, SU2, U1?
If you like, it's the LHC energy theory.
Oh, it's the LHC.
If you like.
So it's the one that's at work
over where you're actually Switzerland. Producing Higgs bosons and stuff. Yeah.
All right. I guess we also basically got to lower energy fields relating to higher energy fields in that one as well. Let's go on and get to your theory, your electroweak flavor unification, right? And let's talk a little bit about it. So let's just start with, well, where did the idea come from for this approach to electroweak flavor unification?
Yeah, the idea really came from a previous work of my collaborator, Joe Tooby-Smith. So yeah, he's even younger than me. So he just started a postdoc job in Cornell, but we both did our PhDs together in Cambridge with the same supervisor. So that's when we started working together. And he did this very interesting work, which was basically, he did a systematic study on the computer to find all possible gauge symmetry groups in which you can fit the standard model one into. So if you like, this is kind of all the different possible ways you could unify the particles and the forces of the standard model in the way that I was describing earlier. There's kind of two things, remember, you can unify particles or you can unify forces. And unifying forces means finding these bigger gauge symmetries into which your known ones fit. And in this list, there was something like 300 options or something, loads of different possibilities. And the reason there's so many is because of the three generations, because there are three flavors, just leads to many more possibilities, many combinations of unifying things. This list includes things like the traditional grand unified theories we spoke about earlier, like the Georgi SU5 model. But the Georgi SU5 model doesn't tell us anything about flavor. Those traditional grand unified theories, as we said before, they just leave the three generations separate and unexplained. So I was looking through this list of theories that Joe produced, if you like, and found only a very small number where basically everything was unified into one particle. You know, just three options, in fact. So there were these three theories, these three interesting gauge symmetries, and they hadn't really been studied before, but they would explain out of the box, if you like, why there are three generations, because everything's just starting off as one particle. just different sides of that coin, sides of the dice, if you like. So then I started working with Joe on taking one of these symmetries, the one that looked most promising, and turning it into a serious model of particle physics. So in particular, we wanted to see if this unified symmetry could also explain the second side of the flavor puzzle, which is, if you remember, to generate these huge differences in the masses of the different generations. So yeah, that's where the idea came from, and that's where we were trying to take it.
And so I guess where these came from is from this list in some way. You looked at these and then you're interpreting these, right? Mm. Interpreting these symmetries. And you have three different models. You had two electroweak flavor unifications and one color unification.
Exactly.
Color flavor unification. Let's just focus on the ones in your paper, which is, I guess, that's going to be the one that you thought was the most promising, right? Mm. In this case, now you have three different symmetries as well. These are slightly different symmetries in, I guess, the largest version of this, or the highest temperature version, the highest temperature version of this. Could you describe what those symmetries mean, or how you, I guess we've already talked a little bit about it, but just go through those three symmetries.
Say a bit more. So yeah, I've identified these three kind of options and they're all quite similar to each other. And indeed, they can all be arrived at, if you like, in a different way after the fact, which is by starting from this model of Patti and Salam from the 1970s, which I mentioned earlier. So this Patti-Salam model was the first to unify quarks and leptons. So we said very briefly before, this SU3 symmetry that we said describes QCD, how gluons can change between the three quark colors. This SU3 is enlarged to an SU4, with the lepton in each generation becoming effectively the fourth color. So this was a very beautiful idea of Patti and Salam, and this had a massive impact on our field. So the Patti-Salam symmetry is basically, there's an SU4 color, if you like, or souped up color. And then there's the electroweak part, which is basically left the same. So it's a SU2 times SU2. Roughly, this is similar to the electroweak symmetry of the standard model. Now, the gauge flavor unification models that we propose, these three routes, these three options, they basically all start from this Patti-Salam symmetry and then further unify flavor into the mix. So we've already unified quarks and leptons. Now we basically unify all three flavors as well. And you can do this in two ways, as you already summarized. Either you can unify the flavors with the electroweak part of the symmetry, hence electroweak flavor unification, or you can do it with the SU4 souped up color, and you get color flavor unification. And the first one, the electroweak one, you can actually do that in two different ways, which is where you get these three options.
So you have SU4, SP6L, and SP6R.
Right. So that's in the case of electroweak flavor unification. Mm-hmm. So there we basically leave color alone, but the flavor symmetries are unified with the SU2 times SU2. And that becomes basically what's called SP6 times SP6. I'm not expecting everyone to know what these groups are, but the six, maybe we can understand the six there. Six is 2 times 3. So the electroweak symmetry started with a 2, changing, say, an up quark to a down quark. Now we basically just stack all three generations of that on top of each other. So now there's, you know, up, down, charm, strange, top, bottom, if you like. That's the six. It's basically the six flavors of quark, if you like, or lepton. So you take the electroweak doublets and you basically just stack them all together, the different generations. And this SP6 is the, you know, the precise symmetry that acts on those fields in the correct way, giving a mathematically consistent theory, very roughly.
Okay, excellent. So now the problem is getting from way up there, way down here. That seems to be a fairly complicated process. Well, I mean, compared to a lot of things that I see people doing, it seems to be fairly complicated. So based on what we've been talking about, now if you're going to be switching from this SU4, SP6, R, SP6L, and somehow getting down to SU3, SU2L, U1Y, you have all of these fields that basically have to get locked into some state at different energies.
Exactly, yeah.
And these are all things that are going to end up being invisible to us, right? They're going to get so weak they're invisible to us, and they're only important up at the higher level. Can you explain how we're getting down there?
Yeah, so that's exactly right, what you just said. So we have this big unifying symmetry at high energies, or, you know, as a proxy, you can think of early universe. So in the early universe, if you like, there's just one type of particle, this big field that has all these different facets, and all these different facets correspond to the flavors and the quarks and the leptons. But it's just one field. But we have this huge symmetry, and eventually this has to be broken down to what we see today, which is the standard model. And this is done by the Higgs mechanism, which we discussed a bit earlier. But because we have so much symmetry in the fundamental model, you know, all the different transitions between all the different particles are now allowed in the fundamental model, you have to break loads of symmetries. And turns out you have to do this in a number of steps. And the appealing picture is that these different steps can happen at different energies as the universe evolves. So you kind of have a series of phase transitions going from this early, very symmetric state down to the messy physics that we see today with all the different generations and different types of particles. And in fact, this multi-step breaking structure turns out to be a feature of the theory, not a bad thing at all, in that these steps end up generating these big hierarchies in masses of the fields at the end of the day, which is how this is really solving. It's crucial to how it solves the flavor puzzle. Yeah, just to flesh that out a bit more, what happens in these phase transitions, it's just like the examples we gave before. So at each of these steps, a fundamental field breaks up into multiple different particles. And from then on, those particles are different. They can have different masses. So for example, in the first step, the third generation splits off from the light two generations, and maybe the quarks split off from the leptons. And at the same time, when you do this, the gauge bosons, the force carriers that previously connected those states, which have now been split, those force particles become massive. And again, as you said, their effects become weak because they're very, very heavy. And so, for example, the gauge boson that would have connected a quark to a lepton is what's called a leptoquark. And these leptoquarks would be extremely heavy in our model. And the heaviest of these gauge bosons could basically be totally ignored, even at the high scales of the LHC, high energy scales of the LHC. But the lightest new particles, which are produced in the final kind of symmetry breaking steps, those would mediate weak forces changing different flavors that maybe we could see. And the idea is you could then go out and try and look for these effects in the LHC and in other experiments.
Now, you've got lots of these energy scales. And you were saying, you know, you have this SU4, SP6, it goes down to this intermediate state, which is, well, it's not that long, but it's still long.
probably don't need to read it out loud.
All right. But when it goes down there, is that first step where your leptoquark is?
Yep.
That's where the
leptoquark comes from, the breaking the SU4 in particular. So if you're looking at the paper, you'll notice the SU4 is gone in the intermediate. It's an SU3. So that step is what generates the leptoquark, because now you've separated off the lepton from the quark. You've just got SU3 left. So the thing that could do that transition, which is the leptoquark, is now heavy.
Okay. And I mean, I see all sorts of papers going through the archive with leptoquark in there. But I'm never really sure what to make of them, to be honest. It's just, you know, I'm coming from a vastly different place. Then this last step, which happens at this epsilon lambda H, that's the energy. Mm. You have these phi R's. Is this the thing that you're saying that you might be able to actually see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the phi R that you're looking at is one of these scalars. So it's one of these Higgs particles, right? Remember, the Higgs particles, they're the things that break the symmetry. Those are what we call scalar fields. This just means they don't spin, whereas all the other fields that we're talking about do spin. So the phi is one of the scalars. And then when that breaks the symmetry, the corresponding gauge boson, which would have connected the two states related by the symmetry, becomes massive. And those are the things I'm saying will probably give the leading effects in experiments. So those will be things that look a bit like W and Z bosons of the standard model, but they won't be flavor universal like the standard model ones are. They'll just couple, say, to the third family fields or to the third and second family fields. You know, this is radically different to the forces we see in the standard model, because everything in the standard model is flavor universal. That's the flavor puzzle, right? They're the same other than the masses. So here you'd have new flavor-dependent forces. And that's a generic feature of anything that explains the flavor puzzle. because anything that explains the flavor puzzle is going to be some new dynamics, some new forces that talks differently to the different flavors. That's why they have different masses.
That makes actual sense. Excellent. So that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so you're also talking about the masses. One last thing that was common in a lot of these papers, or I can't say a lot in these papers that I read, was you're talking about stable protons. So could you just explain stability of protons for us, please?
Yeah, so this was kind of an unexpected, very happy spin-off from some of this research. But to set the context, we all know about protons. Protons are stable in nature, and this is actually the kind of most precise particle physics experiment that we have, which is that the proton just doesn't decay in nature. So in observations, I mean, not in the standard model, I'm talking about in real life. For example, the Super Kamiokande experiment in Japan, which is like a huge tank of water. This sets the most stringent bound on the lifetime of the proton, and it's at least 10 to the 34 years or so. So you have to wait at least 10 to the 34 years, then maybe a proton will decay, but that's the limit that we've pushed it to. That's many, many, many ages of the universe, right? So this is in general a problem when you're doing beyond the standard model physics, because in general, protons can be caused to decay by lots of new physics things like leptoquarks, for example. Leptoquarks can change a quark into a lepton. This can often facilitate the decay of the proton. So this is something you have to take very, very seriously when you're doing any model of new particle physics. So the story for me was with some other collaborators, Admir Grelio and Anders Ella Thompson, who these are people in Bern, near me in Zurich here. We were looking at this other route, which was this color-flavor unification, where you unify flavor, not with the electroweak symmetry, but with the strong force. And we noticed something funny about this option, or something very interesting, which was that when you consider, again, taking this big symmetry and breaking it down to the standard model, maybe in some steps, you actually get left with a bit more than you were expecting. So when you break this symmetry, you get the standard model, but you also get a small extra piece, an extra symmetry at low energy that survives and that's very subtle. In fact, it doesn't even come with a gauge boson. So there's not even a fifth force associated with this extra symmetry. And the symmetry, again, it's described by a group. And here, this group is called Z9. It's a group. It's a, you know, rotational symmetry of a nine-sided polygon, if you like. So this symmetry doesn't come with a force. So, you know, it could be there. We just didn't know about it. But what it would do is it completely forbids the proton from decaying. Basically, this symmetry is never broken and it just doesn't allow the proton to decay. This was interesting because, if you like, we found a kind of a totally new mechanism that happens to make protons exactly stable, and we weren't really looking for it. And this stability is tied to the fact that there were three generations in the first place. And this is quite intriguing because this kind of link between the fact that there are many flavors, which is a puzzle, and the fact that the proton is stable, which is a fact, was unexpected.
Okay, excellent, excellent. So now you have an experiment you can do. All you need to do is to get 10 decillion protons and put them in a vat, wait a year and see if any of them decay. If not, then your theory is probably right. Okay.
Okay. More importantly, if one of them decays, then the theory is wrong. That's the way.
I guess. Unfortunately. Okay. All right. So I think we've pretty much got through your theory. Is there anything else about your theory that you think people would like to know about, people should know about, that you'd like to sell to a grant agency?
Nothing springing to mind straight away.
Okay. So I guess for the implications, under what conditions would you expect to see the effects? We've talked about that. And we've talked about, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about with that? Or
maybe just reiterating a bit that, you know, one thing that is nice with these models is there are loads of different observable effects potentially. Right. So remember, we've got these weak flavor changing new forces. These could potentially be measured at the LHC and our other collider experiments. And then there's this orthogonal complementary signature in gravitational waves, potentially, which comes from these phase transitions actually happening in the early universe. So these kind of models of flavor, and mine is certainly not the only such model that gives these two signatures, but it's very interesting because it gives you kind of two directions of attack. You know, if one of them fails, maybe you'll see something in the other one.
Okay, excellent. Now, I asked at the end if you'd consider what is your favorite competitor theory. Now, you already talked about one theory at the very beginning. Is there another one that you'd like to compare it with, or do you think that we're okay with what you said at the beginning?
One nice thing maybe is to talk about that one a bit more. So if you remember what I said there was this idea of deconstructing flavor as a kind of almost opposite idea. So the idea with this deconstruction was that each generation of particles, each of the three generations, comes with its own trio of standard model forces. So its own SU3, SU2, U1. So this is very different to what I'm doing, where everything ends up being unified here. Everything stays separate and is in fact even more different at high energies. But what is nice about that deconstruction is, or curious, is that it has a nice interpretation in terms of an extra dimension. So you can interpret this deconstructed symmetry as a five-dimensional theory. So you have an extra dimension, and the three generations with their own forces basically correspond to three 4D brains that are inserted in this fifth-dimensional bulk. And we sit on one of those brains. So I'm not an expert in these extra dimensional theories, but I like this idea where you can think of flavor as an extra dimension. I think this is quite nice. Ours is an intrinsically four-dimensional approach, the unification thing. So, you know, you could maybe say we're either a slightly more down to earth, but all of these ideas are quite adventurous.
Okay.
That's why it's fun.
Well, that's the questions I have. Is there anything at all? You know, last chance for the big bucks, right?
I think we're good, yeah.
All right, good. All right, well, then I'd like to thank you very much for coming on here. And I think everybody will like this as much as I did. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Cheers.
Thanks.
You have been listening to Physics Frontiers, episode number 69, The Flavor Puzzle with Joe DeVigi. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/69. And the show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, as well as anything else I thought was relevant, such as the book I mentioned and related episodes of Physics Frontiers. If you would like to know more about Joe, I put up a video on YouTube wherein I asked him some random questions about his process and his education. His education was particularly interesting because he did his undergraduate, his graduate studies, and a postdoctoral year, or multiple years probably, at the University of Cambridge. If you would like to know more about Joe, I did put up a video on YouTube where I ask him some random questions that don't have anything to do with the flavor puzzle, but they do talk about his process and his education and such things. Joe's education is particularly interesting because he spent his undergraduate years, his graduate study, as well as some postdoctoral time at the University of Cambridge. So he has a perspective on basically everything that somebody would do there. That is supposed to be an advertisement for the podcast. However, based on the number of people who watched it compared to the number of people who are listening to this right now, it's more this is an advertisement for the advertisement. So a link to that is also in the show notes. Thank you very much for listening, and I will have another episode up hopefully fairly soon. Thanks. Bye now.